Thank you. And thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's always fun to go someplace and share the Dharma with folks. Okay. Today I'm going to be talking really about mindfulness meditation and a number of aspects of it. Okay. The Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary defines sensitive as capable of being stimulated or activated by external events. Now, when born human, the body that we inherit is sensitive to a number of agents. These agents are energy vibratory patterns that we commonly refer to, they interact with particular organs in our body and produce known effects. For example, one particular pattern impacts our ears and our eardrums. We refer to it as sound. Another particular energy pattern stimulates rods and cones in the back of our eye, these organs back there. And we interpret that as sight. Different sorts of vibrations that we commonly refer to as sight give us different variations of form and color. And that's how we interpret it. Otherwise, other organs, you know, such as the ears I talked about, the nose, is stimulated by other vibratory patterns, and we notice that is smell, the skin for touch, and taste as well. In aggregate, we refer to these as the sense doors. Okay? And it's important to note that we really don't have any control over this. If there's an organ, there's a vibration, and the two come together, the sound arises, the touch arises, the odor arises. And generally, biologists define five organs in the human body as being associated with these senses. The organs in the associated senses are the ears, hearing, eye, seeing, nose, smell, tongue, taste, and skin, touch. In Buddhist philosophy, there's one more organ, the brain. And the vibratory pattern is the thoughts, the mind objects. These are just really another energy pattern. We have another faculty as well. Our mind interprets, and therefore we experience these energy patterns in three discrete ways. In a way, it's like our body is a pachinko machine. These patterns come in at the top. They all fall into one of three categories at the bottom. One thought is defined as pleasant. The other is defined as unpleasant. And the third is defined as being neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which we call neutral. It's important to clearly understand that, like the operation of the sense doors, we don't have any control over this facility as well. We have the vibratory pattern, the organ that we notice something, is sight, sound, smell, taste. And then we go to pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is just a result of being human. It's part of what we inherit when we're born. It's the same as having, you know, two eyes and a nose and hands and arms and legs. It's just part of what we are. Now let's take a look at the effect of an energy pattern falling into one of the slots in this pachinko machine. If it falls into the neutral slot, we hardly notice it. Who cares? It's like the color of the color of the car two spaces down from where you parked when you came to the sit this morning. Does anybody remember that? It's no hands. It's important not to misunderstand, though, that all of the energy going into the neutral slot doesn't have to be as trivial as that example. The real point is we just don't notice it. We don't pay attention. It's like a blind spot. We see it, but we don't see it. Now suppose the energy pattern falls into this pleasant slot. Yeah, we notice that big time. We enjoy it. We want more. In fact, we think life would be just peachy if everything that came through the sense doors went into that slot. Okay. In fact, we often try to adjust our lives to try and force things to go in that slot. In many ways, our Western society feeds on our striving to achieve that end, trying to force things into this pleasant slot. We're somewhat acclimated to that from birth. We strive to go to the best schools and get the best education so we can get the best job, so we can make a lot of money, live in the pleasant surroundings, buy the fancy car and the sexy boat and so on and so on and so on. But this never ends. I mean, there's always something else we can think of that might help make our lives more pleasant. I mean, one day someone might even invent a low-fat, low-carb ice cream that was good for us and tastes great. Okay, wouldn't that be great? Now let's look at what happens if the energy pattern falls into the unpleasant slot. Just as with the pleasant experience, we take notice of this big time. But this time, we want to get rid of it. We don't want this pattern in our lives. We go out of our way to either not experience it in the first place or to push it out once it's entered. We adjust our lives to minimize the occurrence of these events. And who wants to feel ugly or unwanted or insecure or unhappy or confused? We ardently wish that these unpleasant experiences did not exist. We want the world in all of our experiences to be just like we want it to be, pleasant. As I said earlier, having the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings is natural. It's part of us. We don't really control that. However, on a very personal level, we feel that we should be able to control these energies. It's like we should always be able to feel intelligent, resourceful, in control, happy, peaceful. Conversely, when we feel anger, sadness, fear, anxiety, or insecurity, we often believe that there's something wrong with us. At some point, most of us come to realize, intellectually at least, that we cannot escape experiencing all that life puts on our plate. But long before we come to that realization, and even afterwards for many of us, we develop unconscious behavior patterns in an effort to hold tightly to the pleasant and to push away the unpleasant. These unconscious behaviors control much of what we do, how we spend our lives, and what we allow ourselves to see and experience. The good times, the bad times, the ugly times, and the beautiful times all come with being born. It's the way life is. It's being human. We cannot escape it. By not accepting this simple fact, by developing unconscious behavior patterns in an effort to hold on to the pleasant and reject the unpleasant, we create suffering for ourselves. The Buddha taught us that this suffering, or dukkha as it's called in Pali, is not necessary. We can put an end to it. Now this is in sharp contrast to the uncontrollability of the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Those are natural. The dukkha is optional. The Buddha has shown us that it is not the feelings themselves that create our suffering. It is what we do as a consequence of the craving and of the aversion to having these feelings that creates a suffering and inhibits our ability to find peace and well-being. In the Satipatthana Sutra on the Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha outlines the use of mindfulness meditation as the direct path to the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow in lamentation, for the disappearance of pain in grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana. Some people have heard that meditators are more peaceful and at ease with themselves. Or the calm nature and demeanor of a Buddhist monk may have touched them in some way. Or they may have heard during a Dharma talk that as a human being, their true nature is blissful and serene. Looking at the turmoil in their own lives, they seek to learn meditation as a means to obtain that which they perceive in the monk. They see mindfulness meditation as a tool to be used to control or manipulate or cajole the mind to make it more like what they think it should be, what they would like it to be. They want to get rid of the unwanted mental states. And I can appreciate that point of view. Okay? Now that was my expectation when I first came to meditating. And it was a real desire to get rid of negative feelings, a lot of stuff that was going on. I really didn't want in my life. I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. I wanted to feel peaceful. I wanted to feel calm. I wanted to be at ease. Unfortunately, coming to meditation with that or any other expectation is really not likely to get you very far. It's not that meditation doesn't calm the mind and reap the many other benefits. It's that if you approach meditation with the expectation of accomplishing some goal, it is much less likely to lead to anything but frustration. It's a real paradox. The way you need to approach meditation practice is with an open mind, as an exploration of what is, with a determination to dispassionately look at yourself and accept what you find. It's an inward journey which you have to start from wherever you are. in whatever your perceived shortcomings, in whatever your circumstances. Bhante Hinapola Gutaratana, in his book Mindfulness in Plain English, puts it this way. Accept your experiences, even the ones you hate. Don't condemn yourself for having human flaws and failings. Learn to see all of the phenomena in the mind as being perfectly natural and understandable. Try to exercise a disinterested acceptance at all times with respect to everything you experience. He goes on to say, be kind to yourself. You may not be perfect, but you are all you have to work with. The process of becoming who you will be begins first with the total acceptance of who you are. Now just read that again. The process of becoming who you will be begins first with the total acceptance of who you are. In another part of the same book, Bhante Ji, this is what he likes to be called, describes Vipassana as a form of mental training that will teach you to experience the world in an entirely new way. You will learn for the first time what is truly happening to you, around you and within you. It is a process of self-discovery, a participatory investigation in which you observe your very own experiences while participating in them. The practice must be approached with this attitude. Never mind what I've been taught. Forget about the theories and prejudices and stereotypes. I want to understand the true nature of life. I want to know what this experience of being alive really is. I want to apprehend the true and deepest qualities of life. I don't want to just accept somebody else's explanation. I want to experience it for myself. What I find particularly profound about mindfulness practice is that it's so counterintuitive. We all want to be at peace with ourselves. We all want to feel whole. We all want to feel safe and secure. On an intuitive level, we think that the way to achieve these goals is by eliminating the energies that make us feel otherwise. And certainly, conversely, holding on to the ones that make us feel that way. So we continually struggle with ourselves. Mindfulness practice teaches us to stop the struggle, to let go, to accept what is. It is through mindfulness practice we learn that the way to be at peace is to accept our feelings of agitation. The way to be whole is to accept that at times we feel very scattered. And the way to feel safe and secure is to accept that there is no completely safe and secure place to go, that everything is in a constant state of flux. It is through this acceptance of ourselves in the totality of our environment that we come to realize our true nature. It is then that we experience our blissful and serene selves and find our greatest strength wrapped up in our willingness to be vulnerable. It's important to understand that this acceptance does not mean that we acquiesce or that we take a laissez-faire approach to life. It simply means that we accept what already is. What is currently true about our experience in the present moment. And that we accept what is without guilt or blame or self-deprivation or judgment. The Rumi poem entitled The Guest House very aptly presents this sentiment. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. The time we spend on the cushion is just practice for the business of life. The having to drive across the San Francisco Bay Bridge at rush hour. Or having to work with people we don't like in difficult or aggravating situations. Having to deal with a world where millions of people go to bed hungry every day. And where the killing of other human beings is deemed an acceptable way to address grievances. It also means enjoying the beauty of the new fallen snow. Or the joy and wonder of just being alive. Or seeing a flower and really seeing it for the first time and taking in its beauty. Or fully experiencing the love that others give you. In other words, sitting on the cushion and acknowledging all the visitors that come to your door is practice for doing the same thing during the rest of your life. Jon Kabat-Zinn, in his book Wherever You Go, There You Are, puts it this way. We use the word practice to describe the cultivation of mindfulness, but it is not meant in the usual sense of a repetitive rehearsing to get better and better so that a performance or a competition will go as well as possible. Mindfulness practice means that we commit fully in each moment to being present. There is no performance. There's just this moment. We're not trying to improve or to get anywhere else. We're not even running after special insights or visions. Nor are we forcing ourselves to be non-judgmental, calm, or relaxed. And we're certainly not promoting self-consciousness or indulging in self-preoccupation. Rather, We're simply inviting ourselves to interface with this moment in full awareness, with the intention to embody as best we can an orientation of calmness, mindfulness, and equanimity right here and right now. Of course, with continued practice and the right kind of firm yet gentle effort, calmness and mindfulness and equanimity develop and deepen on their own. Out of your commitment to dwell in stillness and to observe without reacting and without judging. Realizations and insights, profound experiences of stillness and joy do come. But it would be incorrect to say that we are practicing to make these experiences happen, or that having more of them is better than having fewer. The spirit of mindfulness is to practice for its own sake, and just to take each moment as it comes, pleasant or unpleasant, good, bad, or ugly. And then work with that because that's what's present now. With this attitude, life itself becomes practice. Then rather than doing practice, it might better be said that the practice is doing you. Or that life itself becomes your meditation teacher and your guide. Before I stop to take questions, just let me summarize. We are born with the innate sensitivity to specific energy vibratory patterns, which we define as sight, sound, smell, taste, and thought. Internally, these energies produce pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. It's through contact of the energy pattern in the sense organ that these feelings arise. It's not something we control. Our tendency, however, is to ignore the neutral, to crave the present, the pleasant, and to push away the unpleasant. It is by the ignoring, the craving, and the pushing away that we create suffering or dukkha for ourselves. Whereas the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings just happen as a consequence of being human, the dukkha is optional. It's through meditation practice that we can learn to accept moment to moment what is real for us and thereby stop generating more suffering for ourselves. As we persist in our practice and learn to live more with what is, we come further into our true nature, which is blissful and serene. Now let's sit for just a moment. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Not so much a question as struck me in the cough by the having a lot of trouble with my separation relationship with my wife. And the trouble I've come to see very clearly in the talk is my own out of balance. And when the talk is just kind of keeping out of balance.
Great. Thank you for sharing. Other thoughts or comments? Yes.
Part of your opening remarks about life experiences being pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant helped me to see, because later on you say that life is beautiful. It's wonderful to be alive. And when you put it that way, life is beautiful because you have the pleasant and the neutral, and two out of three.
Right.
I think for me that would be a positive way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And then the unpleasant is an opportunity.
Right.
It's a hill to climb, it's a challenge to see if you can cope and be, like you say, mindful, forgiving, and perhaps compassionate.
Right.
So I'm very uplifted by your outlook.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Other thoughts or comments? Questions? Yes.
I just have a real conflict with the idea that on the one hand, you're supposed to accept everything the way it is and yourself the way you are. And let us improvement come in. I mean, there are certain things we do or I do that I want to do better. So, but you see, if I fully accept everything, it's fine. How does that go together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really a matter of being where you are. And if in a particular moment you are angry, okay, something you ultimately want to change about yourself, okay, you don't want to be angry in this particular situation. But right now, this moment, you are, okay? It's just a matter of saying, I'm angry, okay? That's the way life is right now, this moment, for me. It doesn't mean that you don't continue to work on yourself so that you don't become angry in those situations, that you don't try to deal with that, okay? But it means in any particular moment, if that's where you are, that's where you are. And if you try to not accept that, when you say, I'm angry, oh, I'm not angry. No, I'm not angry, not me. Okay. That's when you're creating the dukkha for yourself. Okay, just accept, hey, this is where I am. No, I don't want to be here. I don't like being angry in this situation. I wish things were different for me. But right now, that's where I am. Okay. Does that help? Anyone else? Yeah.
Any comments on how your yoga practices influence your practice? There's a lot of books today about mindfulness and yoga, and a lot of yoga teachers mindfulness.
Yeah. I find the two very compatible. And I've done them. I mean, when I learned meditation at the same time I learned the yoga, and I've continued to do both the whole period. And what happens, you know, in the meditation, there's the desire to be alert and aware, you know, just being able to take everything in. But when you do the yoga practice, I typically do the yoga in first and then meditate. Well, when I do the yoga first, it makes my whole body just more alert. It makes me more aware of what my body is doing at that particular moment. So when I sit with the mindfulness, I just start off just more aware of what's going on. And I'm more alert than I would be otherwise. So that's the connection for me. It just makes me more aware. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
I never really got how the brain is a sense organ and how thoughts are, or awareness is like sensation. Because it does seem that, as you said, my ears can't avoid the vibration of hearing a sound.
Mm-hmm.
My brain can't help but think, but I can control, to some extent, my thinking. So is it really analogous to the other sense organs?
Let's put it this way. I've heard it said that the brain turns out thoughts in the same way that the salivary glands turn out saliva. Okay? And it's there and it's doing its thing. Okay? And there's some part of our brain that picks up on this thought, or this thought, or this thought. If you pick up on this thought, it might be a unpleasant thought, and you know, we can kind of go through all sorts of things. Let's say, what's a way? Thich Nhat Hanh, I don't remember which book it does, but he talks about the fact that you're, like, your consciousness is like the first floor of your house. And then you have this unconsciousness down in the basement. And then from time to time, things come up from the basement up to the first floor. And those things you can water, are like flowers. And you can water them or you can not water them. Okay? If you water them, they tend to grow and become a larger part of your life and spend more of the time on the first floor, more of what you are, more of your experience, okay? If you choose not to water them, they tend to wither, okay? And go back down, okay? And things are always coming up, and we've always got this choice to make whether we water or not water. But they come up and down just on their own. The analogy I'm making is like, a certain vibration, your eardrum, there it is. It's just there. And we can make some decisions about what we do with that sound. In the same way, with the thoughts coming up from the unconscious, they're going to come up, but we can make some decisions about what we're going to do with it, in the same way we do with the sound, in the same way we do with the sight. So in that sense, they're analogous. Okay, and that's the connection that I'm really trying to make. Does that make more sense? Okay, thank you. Other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how do you make the determination that maybe this particular situation isn't in your best interest, and you're still practicing mindfulness? How do you determine to move away from something without feeling like you're not being mindful enough,
mm-hmm.
or affecting?
Mm-hmm. By way of example, I've used mindfulness practice to stop smoking. Okay? I use mindfulness practice to stop drinking alcohol. I use mindfulness practice to stop taking drugs. Okay? And for me, what happened is, as you accept, let's take drugs for a moment, okay? You're just aware in the moment that I'm smoking grass, okay? I'm aware that I'm smoking grass. I'm aware of how I'm feeling. And I accept that that's what I'm doing. Okay? I accept that. I'm with that. And I don't judge myself for doing it. But what I do do is I look at the consequences of it. I look at how it affects my life. I look at how it impacts what I do. Okay? And again, I do that without judgment. So as I do that without judgment, without pushing it away, without just allowing it to be what it is, I can see certain things about that. You know, and I can think, hey, my life would be better if I didn't do this. You know, I would be healthier if I didn't do this. You know, and you can ask yourself a question. Well, can I live without doing this? I mean, is this something I absolutely have to do, like breathe? And so, as a consequence of just that being with it and observing it and noticing what's going on without a lot of judgment, without a lot of anger, without pushing it away, I was able to say, this is something, it doesn't help. I can do without it. In a lot of ways, I'd be better off without it. Hey, I'm not going to do this anymore. And that's the way it worked. And that's the way I think it works. It's not, you know, you can accept what is at the moment, but still have the resolve to look at it very closely and examine it, and to make other choices the next time. Does that help? Okay. Let's see. So we've got about 2 minutes. I can take one more question, and then I'd like to. To close with another short sit and a reading. Okay. Well, let's sit. And these are some aspirations from Pema Chodron from her book, The Places That Scare You. May the roots of suffering diminish. May warfare, violence, neglect, indifference, and addictions also decrease. May the wisdom and compassion of all beings increase, now and in the future. May we clearly see all the barriers we erect between ourselves and others to be as insubstantial as our dreams. May we continue to open our hearts and minds in order to work ceaselessly for the benefit of all beings. Let it be so. Thank you very much for having me.